Good morning.
Good morning, sir. And who am I speaking with?
Larry Joe Prince.
Thank you, sir. My name is C.T. Wright. I'm chairman of the board for the Arizona Board of Executive Criminal. I did have one quick question for you. I do want to make sure that you have received a notification that the hearing will be held today. Am I correct? Do you have that? Has that already been presented to you, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, sir. I'm going to pause one moment and get one of my colleagues to make a phone call for me at this time. Do you want to do it, Mr. Johnson, or do you want to do it to tie in one other one for me? And then we will be ready to get started. And it's this number right here, sir. And I'm told it's like 98.
This is the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. We understand that you wanted to be on the hearing for Mr. Prince this morning.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. If you would just stand by, we're going to connect him. We're going to be doing it by telephone. So if you stand by, we'll go ahead and connect you, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Mr. Prince, are you still on?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Richards, are you on?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you so very much. At this time, we're going to prepare to begin the hearing, and I am asked the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson if he would conduct this hearing for us this morning. So the next voice that you will hear would be that of the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson. Honorable Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Prince, can you hear me?
Yes. A little bit.
All right. Is this any better, sir?
It's a bad echo.
Is this any better, sir?
No, it's a bad echo from over wherever that's at.
Well, is this one better, sir?
Yes, I can hear you, Mr. Wright.
Okay, see, so Mr. Johnson, and so we can do it that way, so because we want to make sure that you can hear it. Okay. So just hold on one moment. I'm going to change seats with Mr. Johnson. And we should be with you very shortly, sir.
Sir, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Sir, just for the record, could you just please state your name and your ABC number for us for the record?
Larry Joe Prince, 058251.
Okay, so you're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I'm going to introduce you to the board members that are going to be conducting your hearing today. You have the Honorable Luis Quinones, the Honorable David Neal, the Honorable Mrs. Gail Rittenhouse, our board chair, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, and my name, sir, is Michael Johnson. I'm going to be acting as your lead for this panel hearing today, okay?
Yes, sir.
So you appear before this board for an absolute discharge, excuse me, regular parole or arrest, is that right?
Yes, sir.
You're currently serving a life sentence for murder in the first degree. You became parole eligible on March 1st of 2017, sir. You also have one sentence that has expired, which was for narcotic drug violation. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So we do have your inmate progress report. I see that you have taken several classes and programs. We also have a pack packet here that has your certificates included and the packets that you have taken, and some of your most recent classes that you've taken have been in 2017. The most recent class that I see that at least that we have on file here that you took was in January of 2018, and that was for cognitive assist thinking. Is that about right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so according to the release plans, it says that you will reside at 1547 West Tilden Road, Phoenix, Arizona, 85041. The home is owned by your mother, Ms. Sorensen. The home is paid for with no liens or attachments. You proved to self-employed as a paralegal assistant and also employed by Attorney Joel Thompson. You will be self-employed as a paralegal assistant until the possibility of future employment elsewhere. You will participate in any counseling programs that you're instructed to be involved in, and you will successfully complete the above counseling programs and will meet all necessary expenses with money saved that you have saved from by your family from previous employment. And it says the family has their own vehicles, all homes, property, and vehicles are paid for, and that you have no debts. Is that about right?
Yes, sir.
I look in your last tickets that I see, according to what I'm looking at. Let me just make sure, sir. Looks like according to your progress report, your last ticket was in 2015, where you had two, but they were dismissed. The last ticket that you had was in January 8th of 2015, and that was a theft or possession.
Yes.
That was the. Okay. All right. Also, we had one that was in 2016, sir. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Hey, Mr. Johnson?
Yes, sir.
Just by the way, did the board receive my packet last week of my written statement with my exhibits attached to it?
Yes, sir, we did, sir. We have all the information that you have sent us. Sir, I'm looking at your revocation here. It looks like you were paroled in 2011.
Yes, 2010. Yes.
Right, you were granted parole in 2010. It looks like it was revoked in 2011. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and then you had a hearing in 2011 that was continued, and your parole was eventually denied. Is that about right?
Well, in 2011 it was revoked, and then we went to court, and that reversed that revocation. And then on October 3rd, 2013, the board reinstated that parole to become effective upon the new completion of the new drug case.
Okay. So we actually, what happened is that there was a revocation, you granted parole, the board wanted to rescind, and then you appealed it, went to court, they reinstated you on parole in 2013. And then it was eventually revoked in 2014. Is that about right?
Yes, that's that matter we're all still in court about, yes.
Okay, all right. And then you've been before this board, looks like since that time, four or five other times, during which time your parole hearing was denied, or either they declared that you were ineligible. Is that about right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you're currently serving a sentence for a crime that occurred back in October 1984, where you were convicted by a jury trial for a murder of the victim, Mr. Richards, that you placed a gun, barrel of a gun, into the victim's mouth, fired one round into the victim's head, causing his death. And this subsequently, the investigation was all involved around some drug transactions. Without going into all the details, is that about right?
Except for there's no evidence that gun was placed in his mouth. Mr. Richard was shot at point blank range. Yes.
Okay. Well, I was just reading from the pre-sentence investigation report that we actually have. So That could very well be true, sir.
Yes.
Okay, as a result of that, sir, you were found guilty of murder and sentenced to death by administration of illegal gas. Is that
correct?
Okay, then you applied for a motion for a new trial and sentence. There's a couple of appeals that I see, but subsequently what happened is that you received a the sentence which changed, and you actually received a 25 to life sentence as a result, 25 years to life sentence as a result of the appeals that you had heard without going to each individual appeal. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So in 2014, you were granted. So let me just make sure I'm clear. You were actually only released from prison one time. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
So they actually granted you parole and then went through the hearing and the appeal process and took a couple of years, and you wasn't released immediately from prison. So you've only had the one time that, although you've been granted parole, you've only had one time that you've actually been released from prison?
Correct, sir.
Okay. So when you got that release from prison, you were revoked in 2014. Is that right?
Well, I was originally revoked in 2011, correct?
Right. In
2011.
Right. And then you had another in 2014. Is that in 2011?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And that was having a diluted positive for a diluted UA that tested also positive for methamphetamine?
The 2011 revocation?
Yes.
Yes, the 2011 revocation was originally for a diluted and a positive.
Uh-huh.
And then I appealed it, and then upon the reinstatement on October 3rd, they found that the positive was a false positive, but they found the diluted but reinstated me.
Okay. And so when you were subsequently revoked, in which you're currently in custody for now, why were you revoked at that time, sir?
The revocation right now is, and again, without getting into all the long-winded litigation, is right. Because of the new conviction on August 12, 2013. But as I briefed back to the court a couple weeks ago, that's kind of impossible, considering on August 12, 2013, I was no longer on parole. So the board has basically revoked my parole for an incident that happened while I was not on parole.
Well, what were you on when that happened, sir?
When I got the new conviction and sentence?
Yes, sir.
I was in the jail.
So why did you say you weren't on parole?
I was not on parole August 12, 2013. I was already revoked.
Okay.
My parole was revoked between June 9, 2011 and October 3rd, 2013. My parole was revoked during that whole time period. So when I was resentenced on August 12, 2013, when I got the new conviction that day, excuse me, I was no longer on parole. But the board came back and revoked my parole after October 3rd, 2013 for the event of August 12, 2013 when I was not on parole, which has been my point all the while. The board, you know, I'm not trying to be blatant or abrasive with it. I'm just saying the board has authority to revoke my parole for something that happened while I was on parole, not while I was not on parole. That was not my strategy. That was the board's strategy that chose not to do anything between that time period.
So what was the violation, sir, that you were actually revoked for?
New conviction and sentence.
And did you plead to that sentence? Was it a narcotic sentence?
Yes, the documents that I gave you, yes. I gave a man two pills out of my personal prescription bottle.
Uh-huh. And you pled to that sentence, and actually you've served, that time has expired on that sentence, is that right?
Yes, last year. I received an absolute discharge from the Department of Corrections.
On that sentence? No.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you received a 25 years to life sentence?
Yes.
And so I'm trying to understand how you say that you weren't on parole.
On August
12, 2013?
Uh-huh. Well, the board revoked my parole on June 9, 2011.
And then your parole was reinstated to?
On October 3rd, 2013.
You were in the court process during that period of time?
Yes.
And so this is all subsequent to, because I see many court documents in here that you've been, some of those that's actually even in the packet that you included with this. So I'm just trying to make sure, because you had a board here, it looks like, in October 3rd of 2013, when they had,
right.
They had the board hearing, and it was
that was when it was reinstated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Mr. Prince, why don't you tell me a little bit about what has changed in your life right now? Why the board, you think the board should grant you parole, sir?
Well, you know, notwithstanding that, of course, I made mistakes when I got out in 2010. You know, it was bad process thinking. And many factors were attributable to what I did. You know, and to me, it was just bad process. Life came fast. I was trying to fend off different situations with, you know, prison mentality. You know, my prison mentality now is, I go to my classes. We talk a lot. We're out over here. I'm in the step-down program in this facility where, you know, we're headed back out of here. And we go to all these classes and, we talk a lot more. You know, the funny thing about it is, back in the day, as we say, when I first came down, and remember, I survived this 33 years in prison, and this prison today is a head-scratcher because, you know, nobody talked back then, and you sit in these groups, and everybody has all these feelings now, and it's not comical, but it's good to see the guys get things off their chest, and, you know, and the process now is, with society being the way that it is, and if I'd have just taken this attitude that I have now, back then, and just as soon as somebody made contact with me, or reached out to me, it should have just been, you know what, go on with your life and stay out of mine. Or I should have called my parole officer. Or I should have made contact if they say, hey, you know, or even told the people that I was living with, I got a bad feeling about this and something's not going on right and, you know, I'm in a bad situation. Can you help me? You don't. The mentality that I had when I got out, you don't turn to nobody for help. That's just the way it was. And now it is different. You know, and if you could see for a moment that, you know, after all those years, I got out of prison, and it was way, way fast. It was faster than anybody could ever imagine after it did. Even as you folks, everything adapts every year. You know, life speeds up with the computers and the cell phones and everything. And I got out there, and, you know, the electronics were faster, and the girls were faster, and everybody was faster. And, you know, I just... I don't think I was prepared for it at that time.
So what makes you more prepared for it now, sir?
In part accepting what, you know, the bad mistakes and the thought process of what I put into it and how I ended up in the middle of the situation. That absolutely will not happen again because, you know, we're putting in to play more protections of where, you know, quite frankly, and I've already told my mother and my the lawyers that I know and my friends that I work with, I will never answer a phone again as long as I live. I will screen every call. I don't want nobody making contact with me. And if they do, I'll just turn it over to my boss or I'll go to my parole officer and I just turn it over to them and let them have it. You know, my goal is to be productive, to get back into what I was doing. I was making great money working. I ended up in a bad situation, and you know, notwithstanding the fact that I gave this guy two bills and pled to it, when it wasn't really even an offense, but nonetheless, I'm here now, and it don't do no good whether it was actually an offense or not. It was, I'm here, and I've done the time again, and I don't plan on putting myself in that situation ever again. I'm intelligent enough not to do that. It's just the way it's got to go. I got my mother I have to take care of. Our family's all died. My brother died. My mother's home by herself. She's going to have to rely on me. We haven't always had the greatest family relationship, as you may see in my packet there. But, you know, I'm duty bound to do that. And I told my family I would make sure that happens. I'd take care of my mother, and I would take care of our property and our homes and our property and do the right thing.
So as you're looking at doing the right thing, if this boy was to grant you parole or you got out and you were going to do the right thing, how do you steer away from the narcotic involvement that you've been involved in the past, sir?
Well, that's just the mouth thing. That's just, as cliche it is, that's just the just say no deal, right? Take the work for what it is, live on what you have, and don't be satisfied with life, regardless of in the mentality of, you remember, for 25 years, I never even took as much as an aspirin as I got out of prison, and I was injured, and these doctors were getting me ready to go to the streets. They sent me to a doctor on the street, and while I may have heard of it, I had never experienced what I was taking, which was oxycodone when I got out, and I guess it was all part of that prescription pill thing that you see all in the news now, but I didn't even know what it was, and these doctors thought my spine was so wrecked, and when one took me to surgery, I was going for acupuncture. I was seeing my friend Frank Leach at chiropractors 3 times a week, trying to stay on my feet while I'm popping these pills, and I know now, looking back, that it just, everything's all groovy when you're on that, and that's just not happening no more. Somebody had to hold a gun to my head to make that ever happen. That's some wicked stuff right there.
So, sir, you're a paralegal?
Yes, sir.
And when you're out, you work for an attorney or a couple of attorneys while you're out, sir?
Yes, sir.
What kind of cases did you work on?
Criminal, civil, on my own, freelanced. I helped a bunch of families in South Phoenix stop the mortgage companies from foreclosing on them. I did a lot of that work, just free, primarily criminal cases.
Okay. So the criminal cases, sir, how many of those, were the majority of those drug-related cases, or what kind of criminal cases were is it that you were?
Yeah, there was a lot of drug-related cases. Yes, sir.
The ones that were the paralegal work that you did?
Yes, yes.
And I do see that, that there was some gang association, but I also see that as part of a plea agreement that was kind of taken out. So were you a part of a gang or not, sir?
No. No. I do not participate as part of gang activity. That's a fiction that is perpetrated by some people. And again, I've given you my documents. The DOC has zero allegation. And again, I'm just going to tell you, I'm in the step down program. If I was participating or had 2 years in the past of participating in the gang activity, I would not be in the step down program. They would not have let me in. Out there, I had a contact with a gang member who made contact with me. I shouldn't have done it. And again, had I just said no that day, none of this would have ever happened. So, for whatever it's worth, it's my fault, or DOCs and the FBI and wanting to send this guy to me, so be it. Life is what it is. I've done the time, sir, and that's just the way it is. I got to eat that apple and move on.
Okay, so in some of the documentation that we have, one of them is a transcription of a hearing that you had here with the board, James Hicks?
Yes.
Name was James 16. You knew him?
I never knew him in prison. I met him when I got out of prison, yes.
Okay. So you met him when you got out of prison. So my question was, I was just going back over some of the documentation, and you had an attorney, Ms. Gazelle, I believe it was?
Diesel, yes.
that Ms. Giesel was your attorney. And I don't know, but in a statement that she made to this board, she said that you had known Mr. James, Mr. Hicks, you had known him from prison. However, you did correct that and state you did not know him in prison. So did you know him or you did know him in prison?
I did not, sir.
So, and you guys were located, and he was a valid member of the Aryan Brotherhood?
Yes.
Okay. And you guys were located in the same yard?
I was never on a prison yard with him.
Okay. So you weren't, were you guys, did you handle, in the cases that you had, where you had a lot of narcotic cases, were any of those related to the Aryan Brotherhood or the narcotic cases related to the Aryan Brotherhood?
Not no narcotic cases. I don't believe so.
Okay, and you were you listed as because there's a lot of documentation that we have here, sir. So
okay.
You, as part of your job as a paralegal, you could testify whether a person was a gang member or not a gang member?
Yes.
Would you say you would be an expert in that?
I was labeled as an expert, but I'm not doing that anymore.
Okay. What I'm just asking, I'm not saying that you're an expert gang member, but you were labeled as an expert to testify in court. Is that
could right? I have? Yes. If they would have called upon me, I could have. Yes.
Okay. So how do you get that expertise? How do you get there without any knowledge or involvement with the gangs? How do you derive
well,
that?
I mean, we're in prison.
Okay.
Throughout the years, in dealing with the administration and being on the yards, we're all, if you have a prison gang, environment on the yard, it doesn't mean you don't live in the middle of it, even though it's there. But, I've handled a lot of prison gang cases and appeals and administrative issues and matters like that. That's how you become knowledgeable in the STG and the gang process.
Okay. So that's how you became knowledgeable about it, sir?
Yes. Okay. I mean, Judge Kramer even said in a court order in 2014 that just because I have documents in my possession, which is in my exhibits there, that doesn't mean I'm a gang member or have any knowledge or participate, and I just litigated over it over the years.
Uh-huh. So I'm concerned because, the crime that you currently are in custody for involved drugs and you got revoked in a situation involving drugs once you had your freedom and you were out. How did you wind up? You're saying that you didn't know Mr. Hicks prior to getting out of, you didn't know Mr. Hicks while you were incarcerated in prison?
No, I did not.
Okay, how did you meet him?
He called me. He kept calling me on a cell phone. I got rid of that cell phone. I was on a date one day, and I got a call on the phone that's from a name of Rose. I answered the phone. It was him. He was telling me to come to his house for a cookout. I was like, I was on a date. It's raining. I'd rather not. I hung up the phone. A few minutes later, I got another call back from a different number. It was him on a different phone telling me that if I didn't come over to his house, he would pack up all the people at the house and take them over to my house where I was living with some friends. And I said, just chill out. I'll come over. And that's how it all got started.
Okay, because I was looking at I went through your documentation that I had previously read, and I had read that, and I'm just trying to still understand. If you didn't know Mr. Hicks, how did Mr. Hicks have your number to keep calling you? And why would Mr. Hicks be calling you if you didn't know him?
He got my number from somebody else. It was even in the transcript. I was on that first call. I forget who he said he got my number from.
Uh-huh.
But even when I was at his house, and these recordings where his house was all wired up because he was the informant, uh-huh. These recordings came up missing somehow. But he was in his house explaining how he got it from some guy named Bubbles or for some other people, which was just a farce. And he actually got it from law enforcement. That's who gave him my number. I mean, be realistic about it. That's who gave him the number.
Okay, so if when you allegedly provided him with the oxycodone or whatever narcotics it was you gave him, you were at your own home when that happened?
Yes.
So you still know him. I was trying to understand. You didn't know him, but he called you out the clear blue, and you wind up going over to his house. And then he subsequently, you guys became friends or something when he came over to your house? And you
Well, he what he would do, he would call on an unrecorded phone, and he would have conversations and talk about things, whatever. I'm like, yeah, it's all good. And then he would call on a recorded phone for the government, and then say, I'm coming over. And then, you know, he was telling me he had cancer, and the doctors weren't doing anything for him, and he was in all this pain. And, you know, as you see in my transcripts, I gave it to you guys in my own exhibits. I wanted to make sure you had the change of plea transcripts and the sentencing transcripts. I just gave it to him. There was no drug, you know, there was no drug sale that where I pled guilty to and all that right there. He told me he had cancer. I gave him a couple pills.
Okay. And I do want to make you aware that we do have all your packet, the change of plea. We have the sentencing agreements that you actually made, and that's, you know, one of the things that I was trying to just get an understanding of is that this gentleman that you provided, that there was allegedly an FBI, he's an FBI informant, he made contact with you, you contacted him, then he came over to your house, and, you know, he told you he had cancer as a result of having the cancer and him being in pain or not being able to get his medication. You then provided him with some prescription medication that you have for yourself. Is that right?
Yes, and make no mistake about it. What I'm telling you also, as I was telling you just a little while ago, is that the prison mentality of trying to appease this guy and, you know, keep him at bay one hand while associating him on another hand, it was a bad train of thought. It was bad mentality. And again, I've taken myself to a different place after I came back, you know, and thinking this all through, and well, it just didn't happen yesterday. I mean, I've been back for 6 years, and there's just so much stuff that's happened in my life that, you know, you have to make the stand that, you know, I'm 55 years old. It's not like you just, you know, sometimes when we have these hearings, Mr. Johnson, it seems like something that happened 33 years ago in another event, it's like we just paste these things together and they happen this day and the next day and next day. This is a long-term event. And while this was an unfortunate situation, it was because of that, you know, I still had the prison mentality when I got out. It was 25 years straight. There was no preparation to get out. There was no, other than myself, I was in New Mexico at the time. And, you know, other than working out and keeping my body fit and doing my legal work, and I went to some programs in New Mexico where I showed you over there also, it's just still the mentality of thinking that, hey, you know what, throw somebody a bone, keep them at bay, tease somebody, but it was all bad mentality. You know, that's the bottom line right there. I'm not trying to justify it to anybody. It was a bad thought process.
So you still had that prison mentality when you got out, and then that kind of resulted in part of the reason why you got revoked, because that's what you kind of stated in your documentation, that you had the prison mentality. What is the prison mentality?
Well, it depends when you came down, right? Again, that's 33 years I've been in prison, the short time I was out there, and it's almost like what did this counselor say? It's almost like a survivor's guilt. You always want to help the next guy that's down. And if he says he's down, you're not looking for a handout. You're looking for a hand up, and you hope that somebody would do that, you know, for you someday. And you also don't want to, you know, piss off certain people. Excuse my language. You don't want to tick off certain people. So you kind of, you appease them, and you just move it along, you know. But it doesn't work like that. And you get out there in society, and now I see when I was out there in society why some people were just so dog mean. Because some other people just don't quit coming. And you just got to be dog mean, tell them, get out of my life and stay out of my life. And I get it why people out there were so nasty now, you know? So not everybody. So I'm just saying, I can see why some people were out there.
All right. So I'm going to see if the board has any additional questions for you at this time.
Okay.
Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Prince, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I know we're going back to the beginning here. I just kind of want to understand the whole of this because there's a lot of moving parts in a very large parole packet. So I'm going to ask you some very direct questions. Did you ever sell drugs?
Yes, I sold drugs before.
Okay, so in your youth, you sold drugs. Okay. The
yes.
Second question is, did you kill Robert Dana Richards?
No.
Okay, so your premise has been, for all these years, you did not kill him.
No.
The reason I ask that is because when my colleague made reference to Mr. Richards being shot in the mouth, you said he was shot at point blank range, and I thought that sounded a little bit like disassociation from somebody who had murdered an individual. He was shot versus I shot him. So
no,
you're saying this entire time that you've done in the prison system, you've been innocent.
Well, let's go back. That's two questions. My answer was based on the premise of the evidence at trial. I was at the trial. I have all the ballistic reports, and there was no gun put into Mr. Richards' mouth.
So why did you care about that? You didn't do it.
What's that?
So why do you even care about that? You didn't do it. You're saying you didn't do it, right?
Okay. So as I told you in my packet there, and you know well that I signed under oath of my actual innocence in this case when I litigated this case. So we're getting back into this again where this has already been rehashed and retried by the board before and has been played out.
I'm not trying anything right now, Mr. Prince. This is a parole hearing.
I know it is. So let me ask you this. Let me just pose this to you, Mr. Quinones. So if after all these years that I litigated in court that I was actually innocent of murdering Rob Richards, and I had all this evidence, and I had this testimony, and I had all these experts lined up, and then the state destroyed the evidence, and I have to eat the case, but for the purpose of this parole board, I come into this parole board, and I tell you, okay, I killed Rob Richards, right? Can we just move it along? Well, how would that go to my credibility? How did that, I don't understand how that answers anything.
Fundamentally, as one voting board member, I'm looking at your rehabilitation. I'm looking at your process, where you've been. And let me be the first to say this too, Mr. Prince. I recognize that there are people who've been wrongly convicted. I get that. I'm trying to understand where you're at in your rehabilitation process. And when I read your documents, and you're a very good writer, in between, I still get the impression that there's a bit of a bully in you.
A bully?
Yeah. As in someone who's a predator. As
yeah.
In someone who preys on the weak. Now, you're saying you're a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, but what are you stepping down from right now?
Excuse me?
You're stepping down right now. What are you stepping down from?
Well, you guys know I'm validated. I mean, Mr. Quinones, are you just looking for an argument here? I don't understand what you're asking me. You're asking me questions that you know the answer to, and you know what? You're right. I don't appreciate this because that's all you're trying to do here is start an argument with me. I realize it's the parole board. You know I'm in the STG step-down program. You know what it is.
Okay, but it's confusing to me. You're stepping down from what? You're saying you weren't a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, but you're stepping down.
Yeah, so you see, that is the trick bag here, right? If you don't go into the step-down program, then you remain a validated prisoner. But if you go into the step-down program, then you're saying I have to admit that I'm a gang member. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, you see, that's why DO 806 is not supposed to be used in parole hearings. That's exactly what the policy said, and that's where we're at here again, getting into this argument. Am I getting heated? Sure I am, because this is where we're at. saying? I'm saying in litigation right now in court. You wanted me to take a polygraph to tell you I will no longer participate in STG activity when I was never validated based on STG activity. So to me, it's an admission by omission, which is what you're saying, admission by omission. If I enter the program, then I'm saying I was a gang member. And that's just exactly what you just said. And I can't win with that.
Well, actually, I didn't say that. What I asked was, if you're stepping down, what are you stepping down from? That's what I
just asked. I just went into a program that says, the program says you step down into a program that you will not participate in gang activity.
I'm going to ask a different question. And I assure you, Mr. Prince, it's not a trick. It just is more of a curiosity in understanding the case. Who is Kenny Hatch?
Kenny Hatch was a person I knew from the time I was growing up that became an informant for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, Customs. I think he worked for ATF, some two, three of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, some FBI informant stuff. Stuff like that.
And where did he fit into your criminal case?
Kenny Hatch, let's see, after the death of Rob Richards, he claimed that he ran into Kevin Kobe, which he didn't really run into him, he was looking for him. He claims that Kevin Kobe confessed the murder to him, that he did it. Well, then a year later, he goes to the police and he says, well, yeah, I went and found Larry Prince, I went to a party, I asked Larry Prince about it a year ago, and he denied it. Well, then he says, yeah, but several hours later, then he admitted it to. So here's an informant that waited a year to go to the police to, after he was dating some girl that I knew and had this fantastical information with no evidence to support it whatsoever, and there he is. Yeah, it's a government informant.
Okay, Mr. Prince, I'm also going to ask something else, and that is, and I think it's something that we can both agree on, that informants are often, and I am not trying to attach you to this, but informants are often individuals who are continuing to lead an active criminal lifestyle.
Absolutely.
So, what was Kenny Hatch up to?
Well, Kenny Hatch was robbing drug dealers along with Kevin Kobe, which was withheld from me at our trial. They was robbing cocaine dealers. They were setting up cocaine dealers. And, you know, it took me, I don't think I found that evidence for 10 or 11 years after I was convicted. And then based on that evidence, them robbing cocaine dealers, I got court orders to get the evidence. And I said this at my last hearing too. Lucian Hay, who I don't know if anybody on the board has ever heard that name, he's a world-renowned criminalist, was going to come with my lawyer. They were going to test this. They were going to test the fingerprints found at the other crime scene. And when it somehow all came up missing, my case went down the drain.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. I have no further questions at this point. Thank you.
And, Mr. Quinones.
Yes, sir.
I apologize for my frustration towards you in the situation.
Actually, let's share on that one. It wasn't my intention to be as heated as either. I think that probably turned into a little bit of of an unintended argument. So
I just, just being forthcoming with the board with, you know, everything I got going and all the litigation and worrying about my mother, there's a lot on the plate. There's a lot at stake, and it just carries on. And, you know, I so much want to do the right thing, and I just want to tell the board what this happened, where my life's been, and just trying to move on. And I know it's up to you folks, but that's all I can give you is what I know.
I think we can both take that down a notch. Thank you, Mr. Prince.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Neal.
Mr. Prince, I did not sit on your last hearing, so I've never met you. My name is David Neal. I just have a couple of clarification questions. It's long and complicated, and a lot of times in court, it seems that there were three or four post-conviction relief hearings, whatever, however you want to classify that, but they all pretty much said the same thing. There wasn't anything to redo the trial over about the only appeal that you won was the death penalty being taken off. But, you said, okay, when you gave this person some pills, and that's what you got charged with, that was the narcotics charge, conviction, whatever, that was, as you say, was used to deny your parole or revoke your parole. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yes, in 2013. Yes.
Okay, but when this occurred, you just said the guy came over to your house, so you were not in prison when the offense occurred, correct?
Yeah, correct.
What type of, if you were not on parole, what type of release were you on? Because there's nothing in Ames that says anything about anything other than parole, and then it was revoked, then reinstated, and then later revoked again. So if you were not on parole when the offense occurred, what type of release were you on?
Well, I think because you're using two phrases, let me answer it in the two questions. When you say the offense occurred, that was 2010. But as I tried to make the point, when they were revoking my parole, they weren't revoking my parole for when the offense occurred. They were revoking my parole because I got the new conviction and sentence in 2013. And I was even clear about that. I said, but I'm not on parole. They said, yeah, but you got a new conviction and sentence. And I said, what's the date of the offense? They said, it doesn't matter.
Okay, but you got me thoroughly confused on this point, sir.
If you
commit an offense, and it took 2, 3, 10, 20, whatever time it takes to adjudicate it, and then you're convicted on it. If your parole is in limbo because you're revoked, the hearings are continued, and you're still actually, I don't want to say fighting, but you're discussing that parole, okay, you're in custody because of a separate crime rather than parole. And you got, you know, parole violation and everything else, but it's being adjudicated, so to speak. Although we're not a court of law, it's still being adjudicated in front of the board. So I, in my mind, and I'm just one voting member, and, you know, maybe I'm just not intelligent enough to understand the argument, but my way of thinking after 68 years of life is that If your parole is pending, it's just like when you had appeals going there and things like that. They're continuing, okay, until there's an adjudication, until there's a decision or whatever. So your parole being revoked because of the charge that occurred while you were on parole makes 150% clear to me. But the way you explain it, I'm lost. I don't have college degree.
I have the answer.
I'm a paralegal. I don't speak legalese very well. But my common sense brain doesn't understand your way of thinking.
Okay, I have the answer for you. I think I see where the hole is here. Okay, so let's go back. Now, when they told me I had to self-surrender on April 12, 2011, they didn't come get me. They called me and said, Larry, we need to turn yourself in. We have to revoke your parole. I took myself to parole officer, I turned myself in. I didn't want any problem. I didn't want to remain at liberty violating the law or doing anything else causing trouble. I went and turned myself in. I was taken to Kaibab. On June 9, 2011, the allegation brought to me was DOC knew everything. They didn't bring an allegation from 2010. They claimed I had a dirty raid and a delete. They revoked my parole on June 9, 2011. On July 27, 2011, I was indicted. So, when my parole was already revoked, they take me through this process. They don't amend nothing. They don't take me back to a hearing to amend the hearing to say a new charge. So we go through, and then I get the new conviction on August 12, 2013, where we all discuss that this case, this drug case, we talked about it. We talked about it in depth, in letters, in person, in court. Me, county attorneys, people from DOC, this case is not going to be used against you no more. You're going to go back, get your new hearing on the parole, do your time, and go home. Those were the words that were told to me. So I go back to prison. on October 3rd, 2013, at that hearing right there, we talked about this drug case. Those letters are in my file. They were on board. I admit I got this new conviction. You know, we talked about what happened at the sentencing, which are the same things in the transcripts I gave everybody, and the plea agreements and the letters, and they reinstated my parole to become effective upon the completion of the new case. Well, then I get a warrant saying that I was in a legal drug stand transaction on November 14, 2010. I go to the board and I tell them, with the lawyer, this is nonsense. There's no such thing like this ever happened. So they say, well, you got a new conviction on August 12, 2013. I said, well, I know I did, but we've already discussed that. So let's get back to the warrant. Warrant says I was in a legal drug transaction with some female and a detective on November 14, 2010. I don't know where you're getting your information from. You can call the county attorney's office. You call anybody you want. I'm telling you, this is false. So they disregarded that, and we moved on. They revoked my parole anyways. So again, when I finished the drug case, I was still held in prison. 2 months after I was held in prison, the board then convened again on May 10th, 2017, last year. Mr. Wright was the chairman. He tells me now again, we're going to find you delinquent because you got a new conviction and sentence. They didn't say nothing about an offense date or any other thing. The new conviction and sentence. I'm telling him, well, I wasn't on parole then. So this is what we keep litigating over. It's not legally trickery. I didn't do it. And quite frankly, every time this happened, I wrote the executive director and I said, look, this is, why didn't you guys just do this and amend the warrant so I could have called people and subpoenaed them, so that this is a breach of plea agreement, this isn't how this was supposed to go down, but nonetheless, you're revoking my parole for a new conviction and sentence of August 12, 2013, and my parole was already revoked. If I was on parole on August 12, 2013, then they wouldn't have reinstated it on October 3rd, 2013. Between June 9, 2011 and October 3rd, 2013, I was not on parole.
Okay, sir, in talking to you, I don't want to start an argument or anything, but I have to say that everything you've said to me is dumb talk. So thank you. I have no further questions for you, sir.
Well, if anybody on the board had a question, I'm not knowing what I double talked on. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm just giving the dates of the proceedings that happened.
Okay, Mr. Rittenhouse.
Thank you. Mr. Prince?
Yes, ma'am.
This is going back. I just have some questions about the warrant from when you were revoked.
Okay.
And let's see, this is, looks like a 2011 warrant. And my question is this, that the violations that you incurred, as noted on this warrant, so this is all the information I have, is that you had on December 14th, 2010, you submitted a urine sample which was diluted. On December 20th, 2010, you submitted a urine sample which was diluted and tested positive for methamphetamine. On January 7th, 2011, offender submitted a urine sample which was diluted. 26th, 2011, another urine sample which was diluted. March 23rd, 2011, another sample which was diluted. And March 31st, 2011, a urine sample which was diluted and tested positive for methamphetamine. The only actual task reports that are attached is the one from would be from April 8th, which would contain the March 31st. I guess that was kind of, quote, the final straw for them. But my question is this. If you kept having these diluted specimens, and it looks like you were staffed about them on January 27th, 2011, why did you keep submitting diluted samples?
You know, when they say diluted, it's not like, it's something that, you know, people picture it diluted as like you're in there pouring something into the water or into the urine, something like that.
Or deliberately drinking water so that the urine is diluted.
And it was creatine. I was taking creatine. I'm pounding water. I'm working out. I'm doing all these things, and I don't know why. But I diluted them. I told the board on October 3rd, 2000, I guess I did do that, and I'm not going to deny it. You know, I was pounding water, and I was drinking so much water because I was taking the creatine, I was taking the oxycodone, it just made it feel like there was a sock in my mouth all the time, but I was over hydrating. But then the board found, based on the evidence we gave in 2013, that as far as the positive was, that was a false positive. But I admitted that they were diluted, that I was diluting my system. I had even fleshed out the oxycodone to some degree, but when the oxycodone didn't even come up positive on the retest that we did, I forget all what they said, but it wasn't right.
But so you were taking creatinine? Is that what you're telling me? You were taking that?
Well, that and a bunch of other supplements too. And I was just—I probably drank 2 gallons of water a day easily.
But urine creatinine is a byproduct of the body, not something you take. And that is what was below acceptable limits. So I'm not understanding why. I mean, you're obviously an intelligent man. Why would you continue to do that when we were told that's not acceptable? That's not an acceptable thing. Why would you continue?
I didn't know at first that that's what I was doing. But again, and I admitted that I did that. You know what I mean?
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Yes.
Any more questions?
Not at this time, sir.
Okay, so I just had a couple more questions I wanted to follow up with you. You did pretty much in 2004 your time out of state, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, in your information that we have, it actually comes from your last, it is the transcript from your last hearing. And in the transcript, I'm just going to read something to you so I don't get it wrong, okay? It says, I was just going to add that when I was sentenced, my counselor sentencing said that the following defendant successfully federal lawsuit challenge for the STG classification in 2004. He was informed by high-ranking administrators within ADOC that it would be best if defendant served the remainder of his sentence outside of Arizona in order to avoid retaliation by ADOC. So I'm just a little bit confused by that. Why would you do time outside of prison here and fear retaliation by ADC? Normally that's, in fear of retaliation because of the denial of not being a part of the STG, that it would be in the best interest for you to be in a prison outside because of the STG affiliation and the denial. Is that not right?
You want me to say that one more time, please?
So basically, it basically says that you served prison and you were transferred to a prison outside of the state of Arizona because of fear of retaliation by the Department of Correction.
Right. Well, that was told to us by a part of the legal department, and the settlement in the STG case in 2004 was they were going to send me out of state because they knew that some SSU and STG unit staff was more likely going to retaliate upon me for my litigation against the STG system.
Okay, but if you did belong to an STG, that's what I'm trying to understand. If you did belong to an STG, why would there be any retaliation against you? Because you're simply stating that you didn't belong to an STD.
Well, the litigation was based on the people that was involved in the STG system. That's what that was about.
Okay, so was the transfer because of STG retaliation, or was the transfer because ADOC retaliation?
Yeah, I was transferred because staff at central office did not want SSU and STG staff in the prison system retaliating upon me.
So you're saying that it was staff, not the actual gang itself?
Yes. I just successfully litigated the action.
And so why do you think staff would be retaliated against you for that? I mean, that doesn't seem like something that would lead to ADOC retaliation, but...
Well, I guess you had to be around back then to know.
Well, I wasn't around.
Today in prison life isn't like prison life, you know, many years ago still. You know, you when you sued staff and you made a point, especially in the SDG system, then they'll find a way to get even with you. That's just the way it works.
So you wasn't in fear of the SDG having retaliation against you? The gang
fear in prison? I mean, if you fear one person and you fear the next, well, you can't even go through prison system looking over your shoulder. Anything can happen in prison.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, anything at any given time. There was always the possibility that if I was successfully litigated and shipped someplace else or separated from populations of things that maybe I know about old cases and stuff, you know, people know, you know, people get worried. You never know what's going to happen. But if you live your life like that in here, you're going to grow old real quick.
Okay. So there's the county representative from the county attorney that's actually here, sir, as well as, and it didn't mark on here, an intern.
Yeah, she's here to observe.
Okay, so there's a Ellen Dell.
Yes.
Okay, and we're from the county attorney's office, and Victoria is Victoria the. Okay, so the only one that's going to be speaking is Ms. Dell.
And
who?
The victim on the phone.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, I believe. The Pamela Richard is on the phone line. She'd like to speak to the board directly, and if I may speak after her, I would appreciate it.
Okay, all right. Ms. Richards? Hello? Oh, I think we just lost somebody. Mr. Prince, are you still on the line?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Richards, are you still on the line? Ms. Richards? Let me give. I think she just hung. She may have been just trying to.
Just come right here.
Okay, Mr. Prince, hold on 1 minute. I'm going to try to reach Ms. Richards again. It looks like that.
Okay.
She may have hung up as she was trying to go over. Hold on 1 minute, sir. Please stay on the line.
Yeah. Yeah. Or something. And,
yeah.
And I wouldn't do that. Mess it up. Put us on mute and push the wrong button. I can do that.
Ms. Richards?
Yes.
Okay, this is the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I understand we got disconnected. It sounded as though you might have hit a different button and hung up as you were trying to come on.
Yes, sir, Mr. Johnson.
Okay, I'm going to transfer you back on, connect you back with Mr. Prince so we can continue the hearing, okay?
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Mr. Prince?
Yes, sir.
Sir, are you still on? Ms. Richards, are you still on?
I am.
Okay, were you able to hear the hearing? You just got disconnected when you went to speak on the phone or transfer it or take it off the mute?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So at this time, Ms. Richards, would you please state your full name and go ahead and present the information that you'd like to present to the board at this time, please?
Yes, sir. My name is Pamela Lee Richards. And then, would you like me to continue now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. The first thing I'd like to say,
Mr. Prince, you could hear Ms. Richards speaking, is that right?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Yes, we can all hear you.
Okay. The first thing I would like to say is that I'm here as a voice for what is left of my family. I did write a letter, and I don't want to cry. I did write a letter to keep me, help keep me on track. Okay, so I find it quite sad and disturbing to have to relive and address this case again after 33 years from the death of my brother Robert in October of 1984. I thought he was a lover back then, in February of 1985, well, it was actually 1986, I come to remember. After 3 weeks of trial, when the premeditated murderer, Larry Prince, of my younger brother, Robert Dana Richards, was handed down the death sentence. However, even then, after walking away, thinking the perpetrator was no longer going to be on the streets to do harm to another being, one would have family like this again, the nightmare of this travesty continued for me for another 5 years. I lost the will to live, breathing with agony. It felt like my soul was slowly ripped apart and destroyed piece by piece as if being skinned alive. I was slowly dying. I was destroyed from the inside out, and everyone around me was very concerned, rightfully so. I went into meltdown, reaching 78 pounds within a few weeks. Not from anything other than stress and grief, the doctor told me. I was only 24 years of age. And during the trial at that time, to hear that Mr. Prince actually bragged about killing my brother was another devastating blow. To think another human can actually do this kind of thing. His arrogance and contempt for life and the court really blew me away. The newscast that aired very well was showing the paramedic pulling Robert out of the car into a stretcher. There was a limp arm falling to the side with something that shook me to the very core of life itself. I left my own body exhausted and numb with grief many times. This was not him. How could it be? He was just here. I just spoke to him the day before. I could not sleep. I could not listen to music. I could not look at Robert's picture. I could not go out into the world. And I slept a lot. My family were walking around in a daze, each of us destroyed forever, it seemed. It was like trying to crawl the solid ground while sinking in a deep pit of a hellish fury, and I was innocent. I read books on death and dying. I attended grief seminars and meetings. I even went to a hypnotist, but nothing was working. I even was going to take my own life, knew how I was going to do it, and I was going to film it for my parents. I couldn't, it hurt her to breathe. And the only thing that stopped me from doing that was that I could not put my parents through that again. So I used to hold my breath for long periods of time while lying in bed, hoping my heart would stop. So I was desperate for comfort, and every time I heard his name, my heart pounded like a trapped, frightened animal dropping to the floor or melting into the earth, wanting to die with agony. I did not understand this kind of pain and had no life left, and I struggled for an explanation. It took 4 years of my life, and 5 years later, to the very month in October of 1989, after living through hell, Pamela finally came back by some miracle and was able to find joy and love for life again. As for the rest of my family, the devastation was just as severe. Both my parents are now gone, and I do believe in my heart and soul they went way too early due to the stress caused by the loss of their son, Robert. Leaving a child is beyond words. Aunts and uncles, cousins, friends, and such were all affected by this rippling effect that shattered many lives. Incredible life. My other sibling, my only other sibling, and older brother Stephen, we swept away bang into a world of depression, losing sight of life itself too, and became addicted to drug abuse that nearly took his life on many occasions. And to this day, he is still trying to recover. I wish I could pick my brother up and go to dinner or movie sometime. I wish I could go to his home, laugh together, and play music. I wish I could be with his new wife and children. I wish I could grow old with my brother, but I can't. My brother would have been a very successful, decent entrepreneur, a loving being in our society, a gentle soul, full of inspiration. He had a love for life and children and wanted a family. He was very generous and kind, just full of hope, a definite contribution for the good he would have been, with a beautiful heart of gold. Crush is putting it mildly for what I feel in this precious loss. And just to add this, my brother was getting out of the drug business. He was a businessman, he was getting out of it. And 2 days after this, the mother was actually meeting with a gentleman to get into the restaurant. And unfortunately, that never happened. And we had the news here on that Sunday, 2 days after it happened in that neighborhood. And the news that said, I'll never forget it. The broadcast, whatever channel it was, I can't remember. That they said, not a happy day for some Phoenix family, And it shows that scene, and that was just unbelievable, crushing. So, I didn't know. So here we are at this time, June of 2018, because Mr. Prince is requesting a parole hearing for release again. I didn't know he was released once before, and I didn't know he was involved with the Aryan Brotherhood and continued to be involved with dealing drugs. But when I found out what happened, I wrote a letter in support of denying him a parole, which was admitted into court records on his last hearing, and thankfully it was denied. And now I find myself in another parole hearing. In my view, what classes Mr. Prince took in prison does not give me comfort nor trust as to what he is capable of doing outside of it. He is a liar, a bully, a predator, and he did murder my brother. The evidence showed that. It was his fingerprints on the steering wheel, the last one driving that car. And I remember, I'll share this also, I remember during the trial, and I was able to go into the witness room with my lawyer, our lawyer, Mr. Greg Thurston, and Kevin Cody. And for the life of me, understanding the situation, I asked Kevin Cody, which was very hard to be doing at this time, but and I said, why didn't you stop him? Because he was walking by him with a KG-99 wrapped in a towel, going out to the car to shoot my brother. And Kevin looked at me and he said, because he would have shot me too. So, I really believe that Mr. Prince has been given enough time and has proven himself wholly unfit to live in the public domain and not to be recognized any further in this matter. Some people are going to destroy themselves no matter how much time you give them. I don't think our time is worth giving to him anymore. His conduct is severe and frightening and does not deserve any breaks. I believe he's a manipulator, a con man, and I'm asking, please do not let him out ever. Enough is enough. It frightens me to think that this man could be on the streets again. And I say, God, please do not let what happened to me and my family happen to anyone else. And there is a saying that we must love unconditionally. And there is also a saying, as tough as it might be sometimes, that we must let go of people unconditionally. So my request is that Larry Joe Prince never gets out of prison again. Thank you so much for listening. On behalf of my family and all who have endured what never should be endured ever, thank you for your time. And I also want to go 1 year set off date. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. You can remain on the line while we continue the hearing, or if you want to disconnect, that is up to you at this time. But we're going to go ahead and continue the hearing at this time, okay?
Ms. Thank Richards. You.
All right. So.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Parole is a great privilege.
Could you just, for the record, just state your name and...
Yes, sir. Ellen Dahl. I'm in the capital unit of the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. When I was in the gang unit in 2011 and 2010 through 15, I was the prosecutor assigned to Mr. Prince's case, which involved multiple co-defendants. But again, let me go back by saying parole is a privilege. As you heard as part of the letter, Pamela had been surprised that Mr. Prince had even been released before. When I was transferred to the Capitol Unit in 2015, Mr. Prince's case was assigned to me because all first-degree murder cases are assigned to a capital litigator now at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office to contact the next of kin. She had never been contacted prior to my assignment to the case. I sincerely believe that if her family's voice had been heard previously back in 2010, the board may have paused, because to even hear her words today, time is of no consequence. This was 33 years ago. you can see that what Mr. Prince did, and he did do it, devastated the family. It's been referenced that Mr. Prince had provided to this board a full transcript of the hearing last year, June 5th of 2011. I won't belabor many of the points that were made then. But I will note that when Mr. Prince is confronted, as he has been by board members today, and this is when you're on your best behavior and everyone is watching, he intimidates and he threatens. I can tell you that Mary Jane Gregory, representing the Attorney General's office previously, when he challenged the task urine analysis, and he said that it was a fraud and it was a setup and everyone was out to get him, he has intimidated her as recently as last week, which I said her timing was impeccable. She wanted to know the status of Larry Joe Prince. She is now retired because he had intimidated her enough where she has a redaction process for her personal records. I have received in the past multiple letters. I brought them in case there was a challenge by Mr. Prince, because he seeks to intimidate those who choose to stand up to him as part of the criminal justice process. He accuses individuals of it being a personal vendetta. He attacks their credibility, their veracity, their character. That includes Greg Thurston, where in pleadings he writes that his name was on one of the drug ledgers in the 1984 case. He attacks judges, he attacks prosecutors, he attacks investigators, he has attacked the Board of Executive Clemency. Anyone who dares to stand up to him, include the STG investigators, he attacks and he threatens. In the last case, after the last board meeting, I included the letter, so there's no allegation that I am presenting something that is not true to this board, that I should look forward to the bar complaint for all of my lies. This isn't about me, this isn't about the litigants, this is about the murder that occurred back in 1984, and Mr. Prince did do it. I presented quite a bit last year, I will not belabor that, as to what Greg Thurston provided to me and what the Arizona Supreme Court has found to be true in that case. Mr. Prince did shoot the victim in the face and killed him. He is a validated member of the Aryan Brotherhood. And I use that not to dissuade you. You all know exactly what that process is for, but pursuant to Arizona law, not the validation process, Mr. Prince is an Aryan Brotherhood member. For first-degree murder, parole, the opportunity after a man, the sentencing body, found that death was the appropriate punishment in his case, that extreme sanction, the most extreme sanction that our community provides. He was able to have the aggravating factor pecuniary gain overturned so that it was commuted to 25 years with the possibility of parole. The fact that he even was granted that privilege of parole is exceptional. I will not, no doubt there was good information in the parole board. When you have the information in front of you, you're as good as the information you have. They didn't have the information from the next of kin. You now do.
Mr. Prince?
This is Pamela.
Ms. Richards, you still on the line?
I am.
Okay, hold on. It looked like we lost Mr. Prince now. Ms. Richards, we got to get Mr. Prince back on the line. Could you hold on?
Yes, please.
Yes, sir. Ms. Richards?
Yes, sir.
Okay, hold on a minute. I'm trying to get this call through, so I'm having a little bit of a problem, okay?
Thank you. Please listen carefully to the following directions. If you know your party's extension, you may dial 8 and the 4-digit extension. QH Complex Administration, press 1. QH Cook Unit, press 2. QH Lining Unit, press 3. QH Metals Unit, press 4. QH Special Management Unit, press 5. QH Browning Unit, press 6. QH
You can leave the transfer to this number. Keep the number and try again.
Hello, we've reached the Arizona.
You can leave the transfer to this number. Keep the number and try again.
Hello, we've reached the Arizona State Prison Complex Plan. Please listen carefully to the following directions. If you know your party's extension, you may dial 8 and the 4-digit extension. To each complex administration.
CO3K.
Hi, CO3 officer. We were on the line with Mr. Prince and got disconnected.
Correct, here he is.
Okay.
Hello, I'm back.
Mr. Prince?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Richards?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we got disconnected. So, Mr. Prince, we immediately started with the earphone disconnect. So, Ms. Dowers was giving the board some information, and we're going to continue where we left off at, okay?
That's fine. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. And I would note for Mr. Prince and Ms. Richards that as soon as the phone beeped, there was nothing further presented.
Correct.
To the board. In sum, this has been a lengthy hearing and you have a lot of information in front of you. I would join in the next of kin in asking this court to respectfully deny Mr. Prince any sort of parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest, which is his request before this board. It should be in the most extreme of cases involving exceptional behavior throughout the entire 33 years from when he was incarcerated for this through to today. And instead, what you have before you is a man who has multiple major infractions, who has not accepted responsibility for what he did, who was given a golden opportunity by this board previously and passed his prologue. He has not renounced the Aryan Brotherhood. He has not stepped away from his criminal sweeping ties. And again, he refuses to accept responsibility. And instead, he attacks any one of us in the system who stands up to him and holds him accountable. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Prince, we're coming up on the conclusion of your hearing, so I still had a couple of questions I wanted to try to just make sure I can try to clear up for myself, okay?
That's fine.
Okay. So you said between June 9th and October 13th, you weren't on parole?
Yes, sir.
What was your status during that period of time?
Parole revoked.
Your parole was revoked, but is that in the same time that it was going through a appeal hearing?
It mattered. My status was revoked. I was not on parole. I don't know what other answer I can give it.
Okay. Were you in custody at that time?
Yes.
Okay. And you're saying that you were in custody at the time that the actual alleged crime was committed, or what are you saying? That's what I'm trying to understand, sir.
At the time of the new conviction and sentence?
Yes.
August 12, 2013. Ms. Dahl was there. I was convicted and sentenced. I was in custody.
Okay, were you in custody at the time that it occurred?
Oh, the offense date?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, what was the offense date?
December 15, 2010.
So in 2010, you were not in custody, is that right?
Correct.
And
custody in 2010, why do you say between 2009 and 2013 that you weren't on parole when in 2010 you weren't in custody? I'm trying to understand what you're saying, sir.
No, I said in December 15, 2010, the day I gave him the two pills, I was out of custody. I was on the street.
Okay.
And I was told to turn myself in on April 12, 2011, and I went and I turned myself in, was taken into custody. On June 9, 2011, my parole was revoked.
Okay. Okay, so you're saying what? I'm just trying to, because I'm not quite understanding what you're saying, sir. I'm just trying to get clear in my mind what you're saying.
Okay.
So you were, when the incident occurred in 2010, you were not in custody, correct?
Correct.
And you were out on parole at the time it occurred.
Yes, sir.
And then you were actually revoked in 2011?
Correct.
You were revoked in 2011, so you went back to prison. And what you're saying is that because you were revoked in 2011, that you weren't on parole at the time that you were revoked.
No, in 2011, I was on parole when I got revoked. When I got my parole back on October 3rd, 2013, I was not on parole.
Okay. And was that during the period of time when you had a court appeal going that you rescinded, you wanted to have the revocation rescinded? They wanted to do the rescission on your hearing?
Yes, I said the revocation was unlawful, yes.
Yes. So all of that was occurring during that same period of time over those years? Okay, all right. I just wanted to get clear for myself that, because you said that, sir, and you represented yourself during your hearing, is that right?
During the
actual murder trial?
No, I didn't. At the murder trial, no, I didn't represent myself, no.
Okay, and you
I have attorneys.
Okay, and when you were convicted, I'm just going on a little note in here that I wrote on myself. You were, after your appeal, you were sentenced to life, and you asked the judge, what did life mean? And he said that you would be released after 25 years. That was the allegation that you made.
Yes.
And then you did an appeal saying that you had been incarcerated too long because you should have been released after 25 years, but the court upheld that it was a 25-year-to-life sentence. Is that right?
Yes, that did it. Yes, that.
Okay. I'm just, because there's a whole packet of things
right.
That we have here, so I'm just trying to go through.
What happened, just so we're clear, what he did was he said, I shall be released upon 25 calendar years. I was taken back to the jail, and then later on, I was brought back over without a counsel, and he resentenced me to life imprisonment without the possibility for parole for 25 years.
Okay.
Maybe that's what you're referring to.
Yes, sir. So
okay,
and that was an appeal. That's the same, just a misstatement, maybe like what your attorney made when she said that you knew the gentleman in prison?
Well, I don't know if it's a misstatement. I was just going on the premise of what the law says, that you had to have a lawyer present when you were sentenced. And I made an argument from an on-point case law, and, you know, that's what you have. You have facts in your law, and you take it to court, and it lets it be decided. You keep fighting.
Well, that's what the system's all about, sir. And you said you had that right to do that. Okay, so the board's going to go into discussion. We're coming up on a conclusion of your hearing. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the board without repeating yourself, sir?
Yes, just something briefly.
Okay.
The loss of Rob Richards, don't get me wrong, you know, people take this wrong. Rob was my friend, and I've said this now, I've said it before, and people have their opinion about it, right? I knew Pamela briefly. Pamela Richards briefly at court. I've met Rob Richards' father during post-conviction proceedings. I didn't know them personally. I never knew them on the street. I knew Pamela when she came to court. She brought her friends there. I met Rob Richards' father during a post-conviction hearing when the new evidence all come up, when he told the prosecutor don't have us involved in him some things, and then prosecutor told him not to be talking to me anymore. And you know, as far as that, that's the only contact I've ever had with the Richard family. And their loss, I can understand it. I mean, me and my brother was never really that close. And, you know, his loss, and I don't understand it, you know, as something as terrible as that happened. But, I mean, it's not like I have, you know, any hardships against anybody coming forth and saying that they're at a loss for their family member being killed. By all means, that's their right to do so. As far as what, you know, Ms. Dahl coming into court on the interest of the, and representing the interest of the state, telling me that I attacked her when she has said that before. And I gave this board all those letters, attached to 23. I gave them all these letters of these so-called attacks and Ms. Dahl's representations before this board, and I see that she changed her tune this time. The last time it was, oh, he went in front of a judge and she gave him the aggravating sentence and all this nonsense. Well, in fact, I showed this board at attachments 9. They asked me for any reasonable plea. Attachment 10, Ms. Dahl's email, her trying to get me to take a 7-year plea agreement, and I wouldn't do it. And we talked about all these things, about how this plea agreement was going to come to fruition in front of this board eventually. And, you know, here we are now. You know, I'm an attacker. Somebody call me a bully. You know what? And I take exception to that, because I'm going to tell this board, Larry Prince had never been a bully in his life. Never. All the times in prison, I was with the little guys in here. You know, we all stuck up for each other for years and years in this prison system. Call Larry Prince a bully and a predator? You know, everybody's got their opinions, and we can all stick with that. But you know what? The facts speak for themselves. I've never been a bully, outside of prison or in prison. You know, simply because a man can fight, that don't make him a bully. You know, it makes a man stand up for himself sometimes, especially in prison. But the so-called attacks, you know, that's the government's position there. Well, we say this, and then we stretch the truth, but when Larry Prince puts the truth back in check and says, you know what, bring it to the table, let's have a deposition, and they all go get their lawyers, and they don't want to be saying nothing under oath, they'd rather just come in front of this board and smut me up. Well, you know, I'm going to get an attitude about it, and I apologize if somebody takes me wrong or abrasive. You know, it's not a popularity contest here we're having, right? This is about, you know, being in prison 33 years, me fighting for my way to get out, and it's not just me litigating, you know, between Ms. Dahl and your guys' lawyer and everybody, and this, you know, let's just keep stretching the truth. That's what I keep getting. You get a pleading, and the truth is stretched a little bit, then it's stretched a little more. But if you let it go, if anybody's ever heard the saying, you know, the propaganda of the victor becomes the history of the vanquished, that's what you get. So if you keep letting the truth be stretched and you don't set nobody straight on it, then that's what you get. When you're vanquished, that becomes your history. Well, I'm not going to let it happen. You know, I'm one man and you're sticking up for myself. You know, my family, they've all gone too, and my family that works for the state, I won't drag them in here because somebody ends up making a phone call to their job, like they did to my girlfriend. And, you know, we're just not going to have this anymore. I've stepped before this board. I've apologized to everybody, you know, and of course the state's going to come in, oh, that's just half-hearted, or he's just putting on that. This I am who I am. You know, that's how everybody in here knows me to be. I'm forthright, yeah. Intimidating? No. I didn't ever say I was intimidating nobody, but if you say a lie to me and I put it right and I correct somebody, that's the way it's going to be. And I'd like to make just one quick note, too, on something Ms. Dahl said. She said I wrote a letter to Greg Thurston and said his name was in a drug ledger. That's not true. I wrote a letter to County Attorney William Montgomery on July 4, 2017 on some evidence that surfaced. And that was that Greg Thurston knew at the time of my trial and had said to the judge in my trial without revealing to us that there was a name in Rob Richards' drug ledger of a person that was employed by the county attorney's office, and they never told us about it. I never said Greg Thurston was in a drug ledger. I said he had knowledge of a name of an employee of the county attorney's office being in the drug ledger. I just want to make that clear. But other than that, I asked the board to grant me release so I could go home, start all over again, and you know, if we just keep rehashing it, then we're just rehashing the past. I take exception to Ms. Dahl too. It's almost ironic that she would say a guy who got out should never really get another chance. I just have a quick note. We have a video on Channel 25 here at the work program, and I think I said this in my statement over at Lewis Complex. And Governor Ducey's sponsoring a work program. A guy gets on TV and says, oh, this is great for him, an 8-time loser. I've been to prison 8 times. And let him work and get out and give him another chance. You know, he's made his bolt. He's going to get out and do his thing. And Governor Ducey sponsors that. And the other thing is, Ms. Dahl consistently makes deals with known felons that have gone out and violated their probation time and time again. When she was the gang prosecutor, she'd get them released from prison, right? She was a participant in that. So how does that, because they're working for the government, you get them out of jail, put them on the street to violate their probation, they keep coming back.
Okay,
how is that in the interest of the state?
Mr. Prince,
all I'm saying.
Mr. Prince.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say that's relevant to impact this board decision? I mean, the allegations of going back and forth is not going to influence this board. This board's going to go on the information that it has, and I do want to say that at no time do I believe any member or previous member of this board would have called anyone who came down to testify, whether it was a victim or a supporter that came down, that this board would not take any actions like that. I just want to make that clear, sir. So is there anything else that you'd like to say, sir, that's going to that's related to this hearing that we're having here today, sir?
No, I was just addressing that as the validity or credibility of being stated in front of the board, and we've all felt each other out, and I get it that, you know, I'm maybe not always the most likable guy, but, you know, it's addressing the issue and moving on with life. That's all I'm asking for.
All right, sir. All right, Mr. Prince, well, the board's going to go into discussion, sir. While the board's in discussion, Mr. Prince, I'm going to ask you to remain on the line. However, I need you to remain silent while the board's in discussion. You'll be able to hear the board's discussion that's actually taking place, sir. During that time, the board will make a determination as to whether to deny or grant you home arrest, absolute discharge, or regular parole, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you, sir. Okay, the board's now into discussion. We've had a lengthy conversation with Mr. Prince. He does have information in here. He had some tickets while he was incarcerated in prison. His last ticket was in 2016. However, he has done some exceptional things since he's been incarcerated with some training and the things that he's taken. He says that he's changed his life around according to the information in the packet that he sent. The word that he stated in there as well as in here is that he had the prison mentality back at that time. He doesn't have that prison mentality anymore. But I want to say that Mr. Prince appears to be a very intelligent person, that he speaks very well. He is a paralegal. Looking throughout this information that he has absolutely, which is within his right, taken advantage of any appeal process that he may be able to take or participate in. He has stated that while he was out, he served as a paralegal, and that during the time that he was a paralegal, he worked with basically defense attorneys and helped several people, some of whom were actual gang members, in which he also stated that in his last hearing, and the documentation that we have states that, you know, he stated that he could testify and he could sit down and talk to a person and note that if they were a gang member, he could tell if they were STG or not. And also looking at the documentation that we actually have here, he was actually involved in selling cocaine, which is why this incident occurred. When he was released, he did get involved in another drug transaction. There is some different interpretation. What he says, he gave someone oxycodone pills, and there are some federal things. There was a federal investigation, and allegedly the person was an informant for the federal government. However, there's also indication in here that there was some other type of communication that was taking place, that they were together. The person, Mr. Hicks, I believe it was a Aryan member of the Aryan Brotherhood. He was STG, and he was certified in there, and also
stated in previous information presented to the board that these two gentlemen all served on the same yard together. They were the same level. Inmate at the time, that it's kind of difficult to think that they may not have known each other during that period of time. And it's also want to note that Mr. Hicks, by him, Norby denied being an STG member, although he had been certified as a previous STG member. He had to serve time in New Mexico so that, according to Mr. Hicks, is so that ADC wouldn't retaliate against him. But, you know, it's just been our previous, at least my previous experience, I'm going to speak for myself, since being on this board, that most of the time when someone's transferred out to another, it's because of the threat of the STG and something happening to them, a retaliation of the STG by them denying their involvement or participating with the STG. And he did go to Mexico, and it was in Mexico where he wound up getting involved in another transaction, which caused his parole to actually be revoked. So I think that, at least for me, as just one board member, I think that based on the information that he was involved in another drug transaction after he had his release, he was revoked at the time, that he has had some engagement or knowledge of STG or the Aryan Brotherhood, as well as both while being, you know, incarcerated, although he says he looks after those who are less fortunate, but that he had some involvement with helping them to defend themselves, as well as when he got out, he starts working with an attorney and, you know, continue to work with assistant gang members and drug cases where there was documentation, as he was a person who testified and investigated on behalf of the defense. I find it hard to just believe that Mr. Prince had no knowledge or involvement in it, and because of the incident that he's currently incarcerated with a life sentence involved a drug transaction, which he states back in that time, you know, it's just what people was doing, and he just mainly sold drugs to his friends, and that was his involvement. I just think that Mr. Prince would still be involved in drug trafficking, which to me is the major cause for his involvement in the crime that he's actually in, the murder that he's in there for. So I do think there's a sincere likelihood that he would reoffend and get back into trouble, whether it be through any STG involvement or any paralegal involvement that he may have been involved in, or to sell the transaction or any drugs in which he has been involved in. I don't think it would be in the best interest of the community to release Mr. Prince back into the community at this time. I do think there's a large likelihood that he would reoffend, become back involved in drugs, which led to the actual death and the murder of the victim in which he's incarcerated for. So that's my opinion at this time. However, I am willing to listen to the rest of my colleagues. Mr. Quinones.
Thank you. I'll try to keep it short. I want to echo that Mr. Prince appears to be a very intelligent person, and he has an excellent grasp of the law. And I believe due process, his due process, in the criminal justice system is sacred. That being stated, I think that there is substantial reason to believe that Mr. Prince, the convicted murderer, drug dealer, and I'm going by the legal information that's available to us and have to take it at face value, who previously violated his conditions of release while on regular parole, will not adhere to the conditions of this possible home arrest or parole, and will engage in further criminal conduct, and have concerns about his tendency to disassociate himself from his criminal lifestyle. But that's my opinion. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I believe that a person's past behavior is the best predictor of their future behavior, and the fact that Mr. Prince has committed additional crime while on community supervision for which he was convicted, and has continued to be involved in discipline and receiving discipline in the prison system, that that I believe there is probability that he will return to a criminal lifestyle. So I would not be in favor of any sort of release.
Mr. Smith.
Yes, thank you, sir. Now, this is just one board member's opinion on this. Everything else aside, I keep hearing that the most recent parole hearing is being, the results are being litigated. And if that's the case, I think until that litigation is done, Mr. Prince should remain where he's at to find out. They might overturn it and release him or have him released, or they might uphold it and then he's, you know, then he can stay in. But I think until that's litigated, that I'm not in favor of bringing any kind of parole nonetheless to have to be discharged, and I do think that he's a manipulative sort of person, and that there is a very good chance that he would slip and possibly do some more criminal ways. Thank you.
Dr. Wright.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Johnson. I certainly appreciate your conducting a hearing today. I did it the last time we came before the board, and this is time number four for me listening to Mr. Prince, although he's, if you really count it, showed six, but two of those were, he was in Africa at the time. But I was listening for today to something new, something that I had not heard. The first time I heard Mr. Prince was back in 2014, and as we progressed over the years, I've been just trying to see if there's something that would convince me that he's ready to go back out and to come back out into the streets, and I did not hear that today. I know that he's very intelligent, I know that he has a legal mind, a very sharp legal mind, but I've just not heard anything that would convince me. That's a new that I had not heard. And that's really something that I'm listening for as I sat here at this at the table today. So thank you so very much from where I stand. I am not in favor of General Barone home arrest or absolute discharge. Thank you.
Okay, then I am going to make a motion to deny Mr. Larry Prince home arrest, absolute discharge, or regular parole. That will be my motion.
Second.
Agreed.
Okay. Agreed. Motion by myself, second by Mr. Neal. Agreed, Dr. Wright. Agreed, Mr. Quinones. And agreed, Ms. Rittenhouse. I'm also going to mark for a one-year set-off. I am going to mark the reasons for denials, the serious and violent offense, loss of human life, they violated previous probation or parole, prior criminal history, repeat offender, and recent disciplinary infraction since the recent one, I believe it was in 2016. Those will be the reasons for denial, unless the board has some other ones that they'd like to add or any comments on the ones that I've marked. Okay. Mr. Prince?
Yes.
Sir, the board has voted to deny you absolute discharge, regular parole, or home arrest. Did you hear the reasons for your denial, sir?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Prince, that's going to conclude your hearing at this time, sir. I do want to thank you for taking the time and opportunity to come and appear before this board for your hearing. That's going to conclude your hearing. It's time again. Thank you, Mr. Prince. Ms. Richards? Ms. Richards?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Board voted to revoke the community to deny regular parole, home arrest, or absolute discharge, and we also voted to do it for a one-year setup. We have concluded the hearing and are going to be disconnecting at this time.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Dowd, thank
appreciate
you.
Appreciate
your time. Thank you for taking time for being before this board. Certainly, it's useful for us always to have someone come and present and give us some information. I think your intern, did she leave?
She went to a trial.
Oh, okay, all right.
My other intern.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you so much, board members. The board is now in recess for 5 minutes.